Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2 for Autumn Semester 2010. Lecture 2, delivered on August 25, 2010. The title of this lecture is Financial Institutions and Interest Rates.
Today, financial institutions and interest rates. I begin with a rather simple question for you. Sir, do you have $100?
Not on me.
Damn. How much do you have? $5. But you're obviously worth more than that. You know. See, I got some money in my pocket. I got about $10. You need $10?
Sure.
Oh, yeah. Look, here's the thing, is that this is really time dependent. But in the world around us, there are people and institutions that have money. Probably too much, some of them. But there are also people and institutions that need money. The former we call surplus economic units. Surplus economic units. They have a surplus of funds. Now, in the world, there are people and organizations, institutions that need money. They don't have enough for what they want to do. We call those deficit economic units. Well, you see, that would be a bad situation if it were to just park itself that way. Because money that is not used, the surplus economic units have money. To the extent that they don't do anything with it, they are surrendering an opportunity cost. To the extent that people who need money do not have it, they are giving up, they have an opportunity cost too. Certainly what they're doing could earn a rate of return. They could build buildings. They could make products. So the world has to have, by nature, some mechanism by which the surplus economic units can be brought together with the deficit economic units. They won't meet each other. Maybe they would. You remember the old Barry Manilow song, "We're Two Ships in the Night"? Of course you don't. Barry Manilow was before your time, damn it. Well, you see, we might randomly run into each other, the surplus and the deficit economic units, but that would be extraordinarily inefficient and a great deal would be lost in a process like that. And so we bring in financial intermediaries. Financial intermediaries match surplus economic units with deficit economic units. And they take a little bit of money for doing so. To the extent that this proves beneficial to both the surplus and deficit economic units, then these financial intermediaries will become a necessary and accepted part of an economic system. The economic system of a community, the economic system of a nation, the economic system of the world. In this process, the financial intermediaries don't merely match those who have money with those who need money. There is more to it than that. Because I need money and who looks rich here? Hell, I don't know. Okay, as an abstraction, just because I need money and you have money, that doesn't mean that you and I are going to get together. in the same way that it might be the case that... have you ever had a date? Okay, I just want to make sure.
WTF, you know, I'm good looking. You know, I look at myself in the mirror, I'm good.
But, you know, it might not work out. You might want to go out to Denny's. She might want to go out and shoot moose. I don't know. You know, Sarah Palin, you know. But, you see, it might not work because there are other factors that would be involved in a meaningful relationship, whether it be an interpersonal relationship or a business relationship. It might be the case that you have money and I need money, but I need money for something that is long-term. You have money, but you do not want to lend it long-term. You're going to need it next week or next month. So therefore, in terms of matching the economic units, we have to bring into account, first of all, timing. Timing. It might also be the case that I need $1,000, but you actually have only $100. So that would put into the mix level. But there is another factor, too. I might have a very risky project. It's a Hail Mary. It could pay off big time, but you could also take an ass bath. That's a technical to remind you. And you're the kind of person that you're very conservative. You're very worried about. You don't want to take risks. So risk would come into it too. The financial intermediaries serve not merely to bring economic units together, surplus and deficit, but also to match those in terms of level, timing, and risk. There you go. Remember I talked about those three things the last time? The three features of cash flow? Well, here it is again. Level, timing, and risk. So we're bringing this sort of in a full circle, the concept of cash flow, and now we're bringing it into the world of financial institutions, the financial intermediaries. Their job is to manage cash flow as it occurs between the surplus and the deficit economic units. Now, I want to bring up something that is a little bit vague in the textbook. I'm sure it's just one of those things where they don't emphasize it as much as I would want to. This isn't just a one-way flow. The financial intermediaries do not just get the surplus economic units, their money moved to the deficit economic units. They also ensure that the money moves back from the deficit economic units to the surplus economic units. Now, financial intermediaries might actually perform intermediaries may perform different parts of the flow forward and the flow back. It can get even more complicated than that. Financial intermediaries can even break up and divide the flow in different ways, and different financial intermediaries can handle different parts of the flow forward and backward in the system. We'll get into that as the course goes along. So it can get to be an extraordinarily complex system where we are ensuring that we are providing a service as financial intermediaries to all kinds of different constituencies, providing their desired levels of timing, and risk with respect to the lending and the borrowing of money. And that's just one way it can happen. Lending and borrowing aren't the only ways. Now, if I am talking about short-term money, I would be referring to money that is flowing in money markets. Money markets. So what do I mean by short-term? A year or less. If I am referring to money that is flowing in long-term, 5 years, 10 years, 20, 50, 100, or more. Yes, we can talk about that these days. Then I'm talking about money that is flowing in capital markets. Capital markets. Now, interestingly, in a course like this, there's kind of a bias towards talking about the capital markets. And I try to fight that bias by talking about money flows that would be occurring in money markets as much. For example, money markets might include money markets, what is commonly called money markets. It would also include certain types of financial instruments like commercial paper. Commercial paper operates in a, flows in a money market. And that's something I might actually get into a little bit more today if I have the time. A commercial paper, but collateral. Well, let me not get into that. I'm going to start naming off all kinds of instruments. Okay, now let me take a little bit of a side stream here, and bring up some terminology. Now, in our common way of saying things, we will use words that, in technical, scholarly, academic, business frameworks, legal frameworks, have more depth and meaning. And we have to be careful about the words that we use. In our common language, for example, in our last class, I talked about cost. In our common language, we would say, well, this cost me $5.99 at the store because we paid $5.99 for it. But we know in an economic thinking, rational behavior framework, cost includes more than just the direct cost. It includes hidden cost, indirect cost, opportunity cost. Here's another place where common language does not serve us when we want to be technical. First of all, I'll bring up the difference between an agent and a broker. And then I will bring into the mix a dealer. Now, oftentimes the word agent would be used for either an agent or a broker. But I want to make the distinction clear in this class. An agent technically represents the seller. An agent technically represents the seller. A broker technically represents the buyer. An agent represents the seller. A broker represents the buyer. So if you have an insurance agent, who is that agent representing? Who? Specifically, is the agent representing you? We're Nationwide is on your side. Your agent, is he representing you when you get insurance? No, because you're the buyer. The agent represents the seller of the insurance companies. They're not on your side. They work for the seller of the insurance product. Just like if you go and buy a house from a real estate agent, technically, the real estate agent represents the seller of the house, not the buyer. Notwithstanding what the mealy mouths will say in real estate, well, we got to represent both parties, we have to be objective. No, they represent the seller. Don't let them tell you differently. If it's an agent, by technical legal definition, it will represent the seller of whatever it is that is being sold. Now, if you want a broker, you want someone to represent you, you would use a broker. In the insurance world, interestingly enough, you wouldn't probably, you'll never be rich enough to have an insurance broker on your side. The reason for that is you're just lame. But they are out there. The term for the places where this happens is called it's not anymore. They used to be called alphabet houses. Alexander and Alexander, Marsh and McLellan. Those houses, that large companies that needed insurance products, packages of insurance, would go to these alphabet houses where they, the people there were brokers. On behalf of the company that needed insurance, they would put together what the needs of their client were, and then they would go and solicit bids from the insurance companies. Representing the company that needed insurance, they would say, all right, insurance companies out there, this is what we need, give us your bids. In a case like that, you're talking about a broker. a company that represented the buyer of the insurance. I've known over the years more than a few people who got into the world of alphabet houses. But like the industry has changed so much. For example, Alexander & Alexander is now, at last I checked, it was part of Aon. And some of the other ones have gone top city or merged and stuff like that. But in any event, that's a very nice world, very attractive world. And also the cool thing is that you're no longer an insurance salesman. And if you're in an alphabet house and you're doing that kind of work, they call you a producer. And then below the producer is the account executive, and then below the account executives are the client service representatives and all that. But the money at the producer level is bloody awesome in some cases. But like I said, the industry has changed. Now, let me bring in the dealer. The agent represents the seller. The broker represents the dealer. Oh, by the way, broker, like stockbroker. The stockbroker represents you. If you're buying stock, that broker represents you in the transactions. If you say, I want 100 shares, I almost hurt myself. I shouldn't smoke. That really got... Yeah, okay, where the hell was it? I've lost my train of thought. Oh, okay, here we go. The broker, when you say, I want to buy 100 shares best, that broker is going to bust his or her ass to get you what you want at the price you've set, or if you say at the best price, he's going to call the floor of the exchange, and the floor of the exchange is going to, someone there is going to run out and fight to get you a good deal and all that at your price and all that kind of great stuff. Represents you. So notice that word. It actually is out there. And it means what it says. An agent is an agent. A broker is a broker. Now let's bring into the mix the dealer. An agent represents the seller. Broker represents the dealer. A broker represents the buyer. Agent represents the seller. Broker represents the buyer. Dealer represents himself. Dealer represents himself. And actually, you run into them all the time. A car dealer. Car dealer represents, if it's an actual car dealer, the car dealer doesn't represent you. Car dealer represents himself or herself. In terms of securities, on the floors of some exchanges, you have the brokers who are representing the buyers. And then you have dealers. And they physically, well, they still do in some places, are in islands. They carry their own inventories of a cluster of securities. And they deal in those securities, selling them to and buying them from the people on the floor. And they do it for their own account. That's how dealers work. It's a fast, high-paced world. It's just insane. But it is out there. The dealers in stocks, they represent themselves, and they are all the time trying to make a buck for themselves. As I said, if it's a technically correct use, a car dealer represents himself. Even if he slaps you on the ass and says, I'm on your team, we'll get you the best deal. The only reason that he would do that is for his own purposes, not for yours, because he doesn't represent you legally. Now, there are laws that cabin what can and cannot be done within the framework of incentives of agents, brokers, and dealers. But do keep in mind that there is a technical definition here. There's a technical meaning behind these words. And from time to time in this course, I will bring up the terms agent, broker, and dealer. And when I do so, it will be with the teeth of the technical definition in it. In that vein, in chapter one of the book, there is a brief mention of something called the agency problem. It's more technically called the agency dilemma. I cautioned that I did not talk about it last time, and I will not talk about it this time. Rest assured, though, there will be a lecture where I will actually walk you through the agency dilemma. It is of great importance in your development as professional business people. I have an article that I will have you read. I have a PowerPoint presentation you can follow, but it's one of those things that I want to put off for a while. It involves a lot of economic thinking, some even legal thinking, especially in terms of contract law, and it's crucial that I go through it. But I don't want to go through that in the early part of the course when I'm still trying to develop some of the more basic terminology, which is what's going on here today. So let me take that off the board. That's enough about that. And of course, I don't have a... Oh, there's the erasers over there. But I encourage you to follow through in Chapter 2 the ideas of what constitutes a money market, what constitutes a capital market, the concept of the financial intermediaries, and do keep in mind the details that I've given you, which you might not see in the textbook. But as at this point, let me go on and get a little more technical with some of the things that are going on behind the scenes with respect to the incentives for surplus and deficit economic units to get together. Woman, why would you lend me money? Because I'll get a good grade? No. Yeah. Yeah, you're not going to lend me money for free. You're not going to do that. I mean, you are going to get something back for it. You have to. There is no incentive just to give money away. Well, maybe there is if it makes you feel good, but feeling good feels better when you make money at it. Look, we have something called an interest rate. It is essentially a natural phenomenon. It is the constructive way by which an incentive is apparent for surplus economic units to provide their funds to deficit economic units. If there were no reward for making a loan, for example, why would you do it? You wouldn't. Interest rates are just simply a way of life. They are a way by which a reward can be provided to the surplus units to come together with the deficit units. They are also a means of disciplining the market. In the absence of distortions caused by government or by market concentrations, the interest rates signal the deficit economic units. They signal the deficit economic units as to the viability of the projects that the deficit economic units want to take on. Look, I've got a brilliant idea, but I need $1 million for it. Well, I find out, I'll have a return on this investment of 10%. But I find that for the level of risk of this project, I cannot borrow money at less than 12%. I might be pissed, I might be depressed, I might be angry, but at the same time, I am also informed that my project sucks. That's the reality of it. What is being told to me by that interest rate is that my project does not meet the expectations of an objective market. It's a signal. It is also, to some extent, a signal to the surplus units, too. Well, I'm not going to lend my money unless I can get 14% on it. Well, for other surplus economic units, they're lending money at 7%. That tells you that your expectations are wrong. You can sit there and be unhappy all you want that you can't get as much as you want for the money you lend. But the reality is that the market is telling you that your expectations are wrong. And as long as you sit there crying instead of lending your money at 7%, you are giving up 7% on your money. You see how this is act? The interest rates provide a two-way discipline on the market. They shape our expectations. They cabin our expectations within the reality of economic conditions. So let me start this by pointing out that sometimes in this course, in finance courses, economics courses, you'll hear me say the interest rate or the interest rate environment. Well, you know as well as I do that there's more than one interest rate. There is no the interest rate. Interest rates of all kinds exist. The interest rate on a credit card is stupidly high. There is an interest rate on a home loan, which would be lower. There's an interest rate on a car loan, which might be somewhere in the middle. There is an interest rate on a student loan. There's an interest rate on a CD. These interest rates are not all the same. Something is shaping interest rates. That something is actually spectral in the sense that it has all of these different components. However, we have to start somewhere. Let's start at the very basic rock bottom. The interest rate that would have to always be there. The first interest rate I'm going to talk about is an interest rate that you will never see. It is actually there, but econometrically we can tease it out to us. Take a good estimate of it, but whatever we estimate, it is just an estimate. It is not the real animal. The real animal is a theoretical beast. We can approximate it, we can see it in shadow, but we cannot see the thing directly, and I'll explain why in a second. But the first interest rate is at the base of all interest rates is the real rate of return. I'm put R. Most books these days use K's. If I start writing R's or I's or something like that, yell at me. I think that most books these days use a K for an interest rate. Maybe it's an I. I don't know. So I'll try to stick with K's. And again, if I forget and start writing R's again, just point it out to me. The real interest rate is the opportunity cost of foregone consumption. It's just the pure, unrefined cost of having your money not available for cheeseburgers. That's what it is. It's just a raw amount. If I lend you $10 today, I have no cheeseburger tonight, so I have to have a reward because I don't have any noms, okay? I can't have cheeseburgers, so that means that I can't go to the lolcat site, okay? You guys don't know what lolcats are, God. Okay, where the hell was I? Okay, case of real, the opportunity cost of foregone consumption. We never see it. We never see it. Because it always carries with it a premium. $2%. You lend me $100, I'll pay you $102 back. 2% is your opportunity cost of giving up the use of that $100 for a year. Okay? Oh, concentrate, woman. Do you want to pass my course or not, damn it? But let's say it's just 2%. But so in a year, I would pay you back $102. Well, what would happen if inflation were running at 5%? Yeah, you'd lose money. So you are certainly, regardless of the fact that you will want 2% just to reward you for giving up your money, just for the raw reward of giving up your money, giving up consumption, you're going to need to be compensated for the inflation erosion on the money that you get back. Well, here's the thing. Look really closely at her. She doesn't have a crystal ball. So even if she were to say, I want to be rewarded for inflation along with my raw opportunity cost of foregone consumption. She doesn't know what inflation is going to be. Well, it was 5% last year. Well, that was last year, you see. Last year was last year. What we have to do is talk about expected inflation. Expected inflation. The premium that will be laid on to the real interest rate is not inflation, but expected inflation. We use the letter pi for inflation, and we put an E on it for expected inflation. Not real inflation, expected inflation. Because inflation in the next year is not known to you. You can formulate an expectation, a market can formulate an expectation, but none of us can know it for sure. Here's how it will work. Let's work this out. Oh, who could be my... You, sir, in the pastel blue. Very tasteful. Okay, you're my employee, and every year I give you your annual evaluation, and I give you a raise. Cost of living adjustment, okay? Well, I'm paying you $100 a week, and it's a damn good salary for what you do for me. $100 a week, and so you come in for your evaluation. Now, I see that, well, inflation last year was 6%. So I'm going to give you $106. I'll give you a raise of 6% to cover inflation. Well, okay, I guess. But think about it. Suppose that 3 years ago, inflation was 2%. 2 years ago, it was 4%. Last year, it was 6%. Is 6% going to be what you would want? Because it's not what inflation was. It's what you expect it to be. So you would say, no, wait a minute here. I would like more than 6%. I would like 8% because inflation has been accelerating.
Well, I appreciate that. But you know, I was watching TV last night, and the Federal Reserve Chairman, Ben Bernanke, he's such an honest-looking guy. Well, you know, he said that they were going to crack down on the money supply and that we were going to get inflation under control. Is that going to disabuse you? Is that going to change your thinking? No, because notwithstanding the fact that Ben Bernanke is incompetent as hell, he may look nice, but he looks nice in a funny uncle kind of way. The truth of the matter is that you will have to react as a rational economic agent on capability, not on intentions. Ben, Uncle Ben, and the Federal Reserve governors might, all of them might say, well, our intention is to bring inflation under control, but is that their capability? You see, it will have to be formed, your premium will have to be formed on an expectation, not on a reality, not on a promise, on an expectation. So the very first interest rate we would ever see in a real live market would be this combination of a real interest rate with an inflation, expected inflation premium. We call this the risk-free rate. The risk-free rate. This would be a rate that we would see in a market on something, and here's the kicker, that is risk-free. You say, well, duh. And to a certain extent, it is a theoretical animal, but it is very well proxied by the yield on a short-term government treasury debt security. It is very well proxied by the yield on a short-term government debt security. Because a treasury bill, say a one-year treasury bill, it has no risk. It has no risk. You will be paid back. Notwithstanding these crazies and conspiracy theories, our government is going to default on debt. No, we're not.
Well, we have sovereign power. The government can simply gather the money through taxes to pay. It can print money to pay you back. Or, if necessary, we'll just attack another country and take their wealth and pay you back. We have all these ways. We will not default. So there is no danger in that debt. The only thing that debt will provide you for is your opportunity cost of foregone consumption and an expected inflation premium. Period. So again, the proxy for the risk-free rate we always use in our talk and in our economics, and you'll see us use it later in this course in the capital asset pricing model, is for the risk-free rate, the theoretical animal, is the yield on a short-term T-bill. Now, I want to bring up something really quick here, some terminology. Before I go on with what is called the risk structure of an interest rate, the stack that goes on that creates the panoply of interest rates out there, I want to bring up a little bit of terminology. The difference between a bill, a note, and a bond, and what I mean by the seller / issuer and the purchaser of a debt instrument. First and foremost, a bill is a short-term instrument, a year or less. Now, some people say, you'll see in some textbooks, less than a year. I always say a year or less. A bill is a short-term debt instrument. A note is an intermediate-term debt instrument. It has a maturity of more than a year and less than, I don't know, 5-7 years, a little bit. I got yelled at about, I say 7 years, and I got someone hot about it, but I say it's between 1 and 7 years. Someone told me, no, it's 1 and 5 years. Someone actually was kind of in the know about it, but yeah. So a bill is less than or equal to a year to maturity. A note is 1 to 7 years in maturity. And a bond is something that is more than 7 years to maturity. Now, let's talk about debt, borrower and lender. When you borrow money, you are the seller, the issuer of the debt instrument. When you borrow money, you are the seller. You are the issuer of the debt instrument. A price is established that a buyer pays for your debt instrument. That price is your loan amount. So when you go to a bank and say you borrow money to buy a car, a 5-year loan to buy a car, you are the debt issuer. You are the seller of the debt instrument. The bank is the buyer, the purchaser of that debt instrument. The purchase price is the amount you need to borrow. So, you are at all times, as the borrower, the issuer, the writer of the security. You're saying, wait a minute, I didn't write the security when I went to get my loan. Well, no, there was a prepackaged instrument, but that is just a convenience, a legal convenience, for you writing out the debt instrument by yourself. If I borrow money from you on an IOU, whether or not I write it on a piece of paper, on a napkin, whatever, I'm issuing a debt instrument. The sucker who lends me money, the sucker is paying the price that I'm asking for that debt instrument. Now, what this does is this puts into a whole new light the common terminology, well, I got a bill in the mail. No, you got evidence of the bill that you actually issued. That written piece of paper is actually just written evidence of a debt instrument that you issued that the buyer is now calling home. So when that bill comes in the mail, you wrote that bill.
You say, no, I didn't. Someone printed that at some place. Doesn't matter. What the piece of paper is just evidence. It's just saying, well, here in document form. So when you, for example, get an electric bill, you had a prearranged agreement with the electric company. You issued debt as you used electricity. The electricity company agreed to cover you on that, lend you the money to pay your electric bill from minute to minute, day to day, week to week. And then they send you evidence of the debt that you issued in the form of what is commonly called a bill for the services. You are actually the issuer. When you borrowed that money for that car, you were the writer of a debt security called a note. Every one of these animals will carry its own special provisions. It's a contract. It could be a written contract. It could be an oral contract. But it is a contract. Every one of them will have its own special covenants. In the case of the car loan, one of the most important is the fact that you have to pay monthly payments, amortize the debt down, and all that good stuff. But nevertheless, you are issuing. The bank is buying your debt security for the purchase, for the loan amount you need for the car. Similarly, when you get a home on a mortgage loan, you are going to write a debt instrument. The debt instrument will actually be prepared by the lender. But it is your instrument. As soon as you sign it, you're taking ownership and saying, I am issuing this. And then the bank's representatives sign it, agreeing to buy the debt instrument from you. And the purchase price will be how much they are lending you for your house. Now, this is kind of a subtlety. Crucially important, promise you on the first quiz, on the first exam, I'll ask you about this. Well, you borrowed money to buy a car, something like that. Or you lent your friend money, he promised to pay you back in 30 days. Who's who in this? Who's the issuer? Who's the buyer? All that kind of stuff. I just brought that up here since we would see now why I call it a treasury bill. It would be a short-term government debt instrument. The government writes the debt instrument, and then people, institutions, even the Federal Reserve, goes and buys these up from the Treasury Department at auctions. In the old days, literally, the paper was laid out on the table. The Treasury would write the securities, and then people would come up and buy them from the table. And that would constitute the lending to the government of the money that the government needed to carry out its operations that were deficits over the tax revenues. But that's what I mean by a T-bill. It's a short-term government instrument. The government issues it, writes it, sells it. Somewhere in the money markets, there are purchasers who buy it. And in so doing, by buying it at the price that prevails, they are lending the government money. The buyer is the lender, the writer, the issuer, the seller is the borrower. Now let's get back to interest rates here. This is the risk-free rate. Now, stacked on top of that is going to be a risk structure of interest rates. A risk structure of interest rates. Stacked on top of that. The first one, most obvious, of the risk dimensions is the default premium. The default premium. The reward commanded for the possibility that part or all of the cash flow will not be satisfied. The reward commanded for the risk that part or all of the cash flow will not be satisfied. The default premium. It would be high when there is a high probability of default, a high probability that some or all of the cash flow would not be paid back to the surplus units. It would be low
when there is very little chance of the surplus economic unit not getting its money, all of it back, and all of it back at the right time. So we would take that, for example, an interest rate on a home loan. An interest rate on a home loan would tend to be low because the default premium would be low. Why? Simply because there is not a high probability that the bank won't get all of its money back. You say, well, I know people default all the time. Do you really think banks lose? Even in REOs, they are, yeah, they're covered. Almost all, well, all loans that have a loan-to-value ratio above 80% have insurance, default insurance on them through an insurance company like Magic. The borrower is paying an insurance premium every month to cover the ass of the lender. The lender gets the house back, so the lender has the hard asset. Generally speaking, when promissory notes are backed by a mortgage covenant, a mortgage instrument, there's the default premium will be less simply because they'll get some of the the lender has something even in default. On the other hand, a credit card would have a very high probability of default. Hell, I'm part of that. Paying those bills is sort of something I saw as an option. But that's just the way it is. It has a higher probability of default. In the middle would be things like cars. They might have a default premium on them. But also, cars would, of course, be, a car loan would be backed by the car itself. The problem there is that the car loses a lot of value. A new car right off the lot, it loses a lot of value. So even though the bank would get the car back in a default, the car's value might not cover the amount of the loan. So you'll see this case of D go all over the place, from high default premium to low default premium. In the case, for example, of your student loans, which have gotten, the interest rates on those are rather surprisingly high now, the government is underwriting those loans. The government will pay back a financial institution, even if you default. Then the government will hunt you down like a dog and beat you with a rake if you don't pay. But the bank can charge a lower rate because of the guarantee of the payback on the loan. Let me take you to the next one. The maturity premium. The maturity premium. The maturity premium is a reward for adverse movement of interest rates during the life of the loan. A reward for the risk, I should say. A reward for the risk of adverse interest rate moves during the life of the loan. Now, I want you to think about this. Think about it from a bank, a lender's point of view. You have finally gotten your degree here. You have gone and gotten your job at State Barn. In fact, you are married now. You have 3.2 kids. Ugly ass kids. No, but you have... but... so you decide it's time to buy your first house in a tony part of town, a nice place. And so you borrow the money, and the interest rate at which you borrow the money for the house is 8% APR. Okay, it's a 30-year fixed-rate loan, 8% APR. Now, suppose in, let's say, 6 years, interest rates drop to 4%. Are you going to keep paying on that loan, or are you going to refi?
Yeah, probably refi.
Oh yeah, you're going to refi so fast it'll make my head spin. You see how, as the lender, I was riding on the assumption that I would have a 30-year cash flow providing me 8% return per year, and suddenly this SOB pulls the rug out from under me. You see the risk of an adverse interest rate drop downward to me as the lender? Now let's take it the other way. The average person holds a mortgage. I've got to check the data. It used to be about 7 years. Okay, and then they either move or refi or something happens. You know, a rich relative dies and they pay it off. I don't know. So what would happen if, let's say in 6 years, instead of interest rates dropping to 4%, interest rates skyrocket to 14%?
Keep it up.
You're going to keep that loan. You're going to keep that house as long until Jesus comes back. I promise you. Oh, I'll buy another house. Damn, interest rates are only 16% now. No, you're going to hold on to the house longer than I was calculating you would as the lender. Do you see what's happening to me? No matter which way interest rates swings, I get screwed as a lender. That's why the longer the term, the more likely that interest rates will move, and therefore I will get screwed up or down. You follow me on this? So it doesn't matter. The longer the term of the loan, the higher the probability that sooner or later there will be some interest rate move that will hurt me as the lender. It could be an interest rate move down, in which case you're going to refi and I will lose the cash flow stream at 8%, or it will be an interest rate move up, and then you will hold on to the loan longer than I would have expected you to. I'd really love to have you give your money back to me, pay me back so I could relend it at 14, 16%. You are not going to do that, are you, Sparky? No. Because, you see, you are as greedy as I am. I have to assume your capabilities, not your intentions.
No, I'll start paying you 14%.
Oh, like hell you will. You see the idea? Kind of a cool thing here. You see that as the life of the loan protracts, you've got more and more chance that something bad's going to happen. It's sort of like they pointed out to me in basic training. The longer your ass is running back and forth in front of the gunfire, the more likely even a bad shot's going to get you. So now we go to the last one. And this is where I will caution that the book and I have a little bit of a difference in terminology. The book calls this the illiquidity premium. I call it the liquidity premium. I guess the book's terminology is better than mine. I just put a case of L on it. The reward for the possibility that the instrument cannot be liquidated efficiently. The reward for the possibility that the instrument cannot be liquidated efficiently. I can speak to this as a penny stockbroker, believe me, and I'll bring that one up in a minute. But first of all, let me see. Gotta find someone I can do this with here. Ah. A piece of paper. And where the hell is this? Ah, ow! How did safety straight pins get in? Oh, never mind. Okay, here. Let's see here. I'm trying to find someone who looks really respectable. Not in this class. Okay, here we go. We're going to do it this way. Madam, you have two friends. No more. No, you have two men you know. One of them, he comes from a very fine family. The world is his. He's going to get his degree here, and then he's going to travel the world. He's got his job. He's going to be made an executive vice president of his father's Fortune 500 company. And he comes to you, and he wants to lend you, or rather borrow from you, $100. And he'll pay you back in a year. Now, and he actually has his father's lawyer write up a legal IOU promissory note, or a promissory bill, in this case, since it's for a year. And it's all ready. There's a gold seal on it. There's a little fresh Werther's original on there for you as just a little bit of an incentive. Okay. And he says, I want you to think of an interest rate. Well, you're thinking about this. And then I come up to you. A veritable hobo, a street bum. Indeed, I am sort of maybe not quite there anymore.
I know you. Damn, you are my sister. I need $100. Yeah. I got a piece of paper. I'm going to write right here. I owe you. Oh, damn, this thing, the lid's broken on it. Well, you can tell. I'm going to write real. I owe you $100. Hey, damn note right there. Yeah.
Don't shake your head. I'll pay you whatever interest rate you... I'll pay you whatever you need. I'll pay you whatever interest rate. Now, who are you going to charge a lower interest rate to? Him or me? Well, one thing, he's less risky than I am. But there's something else about it. You see, if you really needed that $100 back during the course of the year, you could probably sell the instrument to someone else. Well, he's going to pay me back $100. Could you, could you take over this loan, give me my $100 back, and I'll tell him to pay you? But you see, with me, are you going to be able to sell this piece of paper to anyone, anywhere? Oh, hell no. You see, you're going to have to charge me a premium just for the fact that you cannot liquidate this piece of paper as efficiently as you can his piece of paper. That's what we mean when we talk about high-risk loans, because a high-risk loan, normally loans, companies sell them and buy them back and forth among each other all the time. But when they're high-risk, they might not be able to find a liquid market to be able to dispose of loans when they need to. So that liquidity premium, I brought up the fact that I was a broker. Now, if I had inventories, if someone had said, I want to sell my Microsoft stock, in my house, I would have bought it right away because I know I could have sold it right away. But when someone came to me and said, I need to sell some small podunk company that no one's ever heard of, I need to get rid of their stock. Oh, I'm going to mark down that stock real fast on them. I don't care if you saw in the pink sheets that it was worth 30 cents a share. I'll buy it from you for 10 cents a share because there is so much risk that I can't unload this stock. I might not be able to make a market in this. I might not be able to find some sucker who would buy this trash from me. That's why there will be a liquidity premium, whereas the book calls it an illiquidity premium, for the possibility that it would be difficult to unload the instrument before it comes due, which you might have to do. So now, putting that all together, what I put right there, what I did right there, that is what I mean by an interest rate. It is actually a complex combination of pieces, and each one could be different for a given financial instrument. Now, on the next time we meet, Monday, as a happy family, I'll continue with this subject, and then we'll move on to chapter 3. Watch the website this weekend. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.